February 78. Okay, this is talking with Dick McGee on 27th February 78 at Radio Physics in Sydney. So, can you tell me what your education was, what field it was in, and when you got started here at Radio Physics?
Right. I've been a university vocation student at the National Standards Laboratory, and I'd got interested in radio astronomy there because the two laboratories were in the same building at Sydney University. So I applied for a job immediately on graduating in 1951, and I started working with Ron Bracewell on long-wave D-layer ionosphere work.
Now, what was your training in? Was it physics or...?
Yes, physics.
Yes.
I had a degree in physics, yeah. The D-layer work didn't come to very much. Bracewell had done his work at Cambridge, and he was attempting to follow it up here. We sent a receiver down to Macquarie Island and got a few results, but nothing was really published on that. Then I started helping Dr. Joe Pawsey designing for hole in the ground type spherical radio telescopes of sizes up to, say, 600 feet diameter. And we spent something like 6 months on that in 1950, end of 52, immediately after the ERSI in 52 and early 53. Pawsey was interested. I suggested that instead of the Jodrell Bank type overground structure, we follow up what Bolton had been thinking about at Dover Heights and look for some sort of terrain that was appropriate. Mm-hmm. And
Bolton, how large was his hole?
80 foot.
80 foot.
Yeah. Well, Joe Pawsey was very keen on this type of thing, particularly going on picnics, and we used to go on picnics with him looking for sites at Picton and everywhere. And then with Keith McAllister, who's our divisional engineer, who'd done a lot of aerial design for us, and a geologist friend of mine, who's Cliff McElroy, we started looking at sites around Sydney here, and particularly in the Blue Mountains, and we found a site, a very good site, up at Falconbridge in the Blue Mountains, about 40 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
And we got our designs for a 600-foot effective aperture. It was something like 1,200 foot across, and we drew up a design for that. Now, in the meantime, I should say at this stage that Pawsey had realised all the difficulties that you have trying to feed a spherical reflector, as we know now, and he'd had me working on early designs for that. Now, around about this time...
Was it clear you had to use a line feed, or was that something that had to be thought about, or how much was known at that time about spherical reflectors, or were you starting from zero?
Well, I was starting from zero, and Pawsey had realised that you had to have the phase right for feeding, and he of course, Pawsey had been aerial feeding and so on was his specialty.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd brought me along, directed me into design, symbol designs for line feeds at this early stage. This is 53, say. Meantime, we had Bowen thinking about totally steerable aerial, and Bowen brought in an engineering friend of his, a mechanical engineer, I think, to actually rule on. He put up his idea, and Pawsey put up his idea, and the decision was that the fully steerable dish would be the thing. So Bowen cut right across. He said, right, forget about that other project, cut it off. And that's where.
Now, who made the decision? Bowen made
it? Offshore, yeah. Bowen was the chief, Pawsey was the assistant chief. Pawsey was in charge of radio astronomy. Bowen, although he was on rain physics and the like, was in charge of the lab, and in fact.
Right, and what basis did he favour the fully steerable?
Well, flexibility, and I can say now, I think good foresight. I think we obviously we didn't foresee all the troubles as I think happened at Arecibo, and I feel it was a pretty good decision. The Pawsey one, Joe, was a pink or an ordinary string and sealing wax man from Cambridge. That was their style, and if you could do a thing cheaply, then Joe would do it that way.
So that's why it appealed to him. It took
yeah, sure. He thought that he liked the idea. If you could think out, if you could do something by thinking, then that was good. And obviously, as you'll find from the other people who interview, that he favoured things like the Mills Cross and the
right.
Crisscross. That really appealed to him because it was.
They were not quite so brute force. They were cleverer in a sense. But now let me ask you about the relationship. I know at that time that also in the running for the money that was available was a larger Mills Cross and so forth, and that. The big dish won out over them also. Now, was this a sort of a prior decision to the...
This, if I remember, this decision came along a bit later than that as to whether the Mills Cross didn't get going, I'm guessing now, till 54, 55. Have you got any...
Well, 53 was the paper reporting the model results.
Okay, well, so they had it out at Potts Hill in 53, yeah. And then they built it at Fleury.